It's a great pleasure to welcome back to the WFMT studios Emmanuel Viaume. Emmanuel Viaume has done us the honor of checking in with us just about each of the last few times he's been in Chicago, and he's been in Chicago with Lyric Opera of Chicago, the Grant Park Music Festival, the Chicago Symphony Orchestra, done well for himself in sharing his time and talent with downtown Chicago and all of these wonderful international institutions. And he is back to head two runs, really, of La Boheme at Lyric Opera of Chicago. When you're first hearing this, you will have just heard opening night of Cast One at Lyric Opera on January 21st, 2013. And then again in March and April, there will be another run. So Emmanuel will by then have collected, I'm sure, the keys to the city of Chicago, or at least he'll have the keys to his apartment, having been here for a nice residency. We always enjoy catching up with Emmanuel because we get a sense of what it's like to be in a career as a transatlantic conductor and who does both opera and symphonic work, and also because he just always has interesting things to say about just about everything. Emmanuel Viaume, welcome back to Chicago and welcome back to WFMT.
Always great to be with you, and I love your show. And many people listen to it, actually, through the internet in Europe. So I get sometimes remarks when I am in Slovakia or in Slovenia or in Paris. Oh, I listened to the show of Andrew the other day.
Slovenia is the main place where we are listened to, although my Slovenian listener just wrote to me.
You mean
that
you're one listener?
That
you mean
he's now in graduate school in Atlanta. So, right. You know, there goes my. Well, you can maybe talk us up again, because one of the things that you do is you are artistic director and chief conductor of the Slovenian Philharmonic. You're also in Bratislava with the Slovak Philharmonic.
Absolutely.
And we'll come back to those in a moment. But I thought it would be good to start off with Boheme. Emmanuel, tell us some things that we don't know about La Boheme, or that we think we know but we're wrong about La Boheme. And this is on a good game show. Emmanuel did not see these questions before.
Yes. This is a trap. I think Boheme is always considered as one of those five best operas in the world. And it's definitely a show that one should see if he has never been to opera or to even experience classical music. Great musicians have dismissed Puccini as a second-rate composer. Gérard Mortier, director of the City Opera for a few hours and former director of the Paris Opera, said that during his tenure at the Paris Opera, there wouldn't be any Puccini operas because Puccini was just a bad composer. And it's an opinion you hear from many people who are supposedly very educated and smart. And it's stunning to me. The reason is that Puccini is dismissed because it's considered as sentimental music. And feelings in music are considered by a certain school, especially of the 20th century, as something that needs to be banned and that is not really high art. And I think it's a real misunderstanding on how this works. That means that the feelings are very important in the process, but they are not the ultimate point of what Puccini is doing. What he's doing is first and foremost a dramatic construction that has a poetical value. And without the feelings, you cannot understand that poetical value. So in a time of art during, let's say, hardcore 20th century, where the purpose of great music was to understand structure and sound independently from meanings that would be emotional meanings, that music was banned. But the ultimate point of the music of Puccini is not to bask in feelings, not even necessarily to bask in a catharsis of feelings, but to express very, very powerfully some poetic feelings. And in that way, Bohème is certainly one of his best operas.
And it sounds as if you're saying that we should emphasize the word poetic.
More than sentimental.
Than sentimental, or even
but
more
that
than feelings
poetry,
per se.
Absolutely. But that poetry goes through the feelings and the sentiments. Mm-hmm. So I don't want to radically say it's not about feelings. The feelings are very important. They are actually the material. They are the marble of this incredible statue. But the ultimate point is the poetry. The first entrance of Mimi in the piece, Chi è là una donna, all of a sudden the music has such an intensity, such a truth in itself, that it's at the level of the greatest poet. Mm-hmm. And it reveals something about us, about life, about the world, that is expressed in a way that is so anew that it makes us be different. It makes us understand deeper who we are and what the world around us is. And that's one of the mission of art. So in that way, it's the highest art. Mm-hmm. And I think nowadays we can understand this a little better than maybe, you know, in the 70s, 50s or 80s, because we are not anymore oppressed by our super ego that says, you know, if there are feelings, it's just wrong, it's bad taste, you cannot do it.
It's interesting. One, I think in the main, you're absolutely right. Number two, it's interesting, though, that the critique or the banishment without critique, really, of much of Puccini or all of Puccini even by certain perspectives wasn't throwing out sentiment altogether, because certainly if we go to music of Beethoven or of Mozart, we hear feelings, we have sentiments. It's the idea that there was only sentiment or that this sentiment was cheap. Now, but the argument was against sentiment, period, but there wasn't enough ammunition maybe to go after some of these other canonical composers. And yet you could say with Puccini, but there's nothing else there. And there's no symphonic work. There's one string quartet. This is not a musician, because a musician works with abstraction to take us to a certain point. So this is a boulevardier. This is somebody who takes melodrama and puts them
right,
which he did, but he transformed melodramas.
He did, and I think simply he didn't do symphonies, because that's not where his genius could express himself. But that doesn't mean there is no genius there. Mm-hmm. And you mentioned Mozart. Of course, there are feelings in Mozart, but there is a whole, let's say, also school in the last 50 years that has, in my opinion, misunderstood some of Mozart by doing his symphonies like they were abstract works, totally independent from feelings, anger, passion, wittiness, dirtiness, and all excitement of life. And this is the same composer that is so witty when he does Così or Le Nozze di Figaro. And I think you cannot ignore that composer when you do even the Jupiter Symphony.
Right.
And we need to reconcile those two aspects.
The other thing that interests me, and I think some of our listeners may have been puzzled a bit or arched their eyebrows a bit at what you were describing, is not that anything that you said wasn't true, because it all is true, but that there's still remains today, and certainly particularly in this second 50 years of the 20th century, a real distinction of attitudes in so many areas between Europe and the United States, between continental Europe and Britain, between France and other countries. Because the periods that you're talking about, the 50s, 70s, 80s, were the periods where if you start with a center at the Metropolitan Opera and at La Scala in Milan, you have the second greatest set of Puccini singers that ever lived, mm-hmm. Because you have Pavarotti and you have Scotto and Franny and these people, and you have the greatest popularity of these operas. I mean, there's a period where the Lyric Opera is putting on two or three Puccini operas in a season, mm-hmm. or two in a season and a special concert, something like that. And then we move now in a way the normalization in the United States is to say, well, we don't have to have Puccini every season, mm-hmm. because we've done every one so many times, or let's do La Rondine because we haven't done it. So whereas maybe in Europe, where there was more of this assault from theoreticians, from some conductors, and the same with Mozart, you had a tradition with Bernstein in New York, with Schulte in Chicago, of other people where there was a lot of red meat Mozart, you could say. Mm-hmm. And so, but these distinctions, even in this internet and supersonic jet travel world, just still continue in the same way that artists are known in one place or not
right.
another.
And it's true that the United States has been more, let's say, opened the world of opera and in a certain way more tolerant and pragmatical when it comes to repertoire. And this is very interesting when you are an artistic director, actually, of an institution. As you know, I was the artistic director music director in Charleston, Spoleto, USA, for many years. And it was very interesting. I could program sometimes works that were off the beaten path, and people would trust us and have a very, very open attitude toward new repertoire because there is less expectation somehow. There is mm-hmm. less mental and ideological preconception on what is good and what is not good and what is expected from an institution or not. And Puccini, as much as it has, and you're right to point that, more looked down in Europe than in the States, Puccini always works with the audience. Whatever you want to say, it does work. It does attract people, and people who go and see a good opera by Puccini are going to recommend it to their friends. So it's a good box office.
As you also said, it's a great introduction. I'm thinking of how many people the first opera they saw or the chance to invite somebody to an opera is Puccini, and very often Bohème. It's a great date opera.
Right.
And I think as a kid, of course, we were taken to see productions at Lyric, school children. And interestingly, the first opera that we saw as a grand opera when we were 10 or so, when I was in the Chicago Public Schools, was Madama Butterfly. And I always thought, what does this say to kids, you know?
Right.
This American guy comes to Japan, lies to the Japanese girl who's a prostitute. She has a baby. He steals the baby. She commits suicide. Don't you love opera children? You know?
Right. Well, it's for the sake of art.
Right.
But having said all of this,
yes.
That doesn't mean, as a conductor or as a singer or a stage director, you should bask only in the sentimentality
right.
of the piece. You have to absolutely go, which I think is the art of the piece, which is its poetical qualities. And it's very difficult because you know that piece so well.
Right.
It's like, you know, the first act, it's like a competition for singers or a big audition because the two main arias are the first arias a tenor or a soprano is going to sing in an audition. And in order to give this quality of freshness, of a new life just there happening, this is very challenging for the performers and for the singers.
And also, I would imagine, because the characters they're playing, particularly in the wonderful big group scenes, they are show-offs.
Right.
These are kids in Bohemian right. Paris who are, I'm a painter, I'm a singer, but we don't really see their work so much.
Right.
I'm writing all the time.
And I'm not sure we want to see
exactly.
their work, actually, or hear their music.
Right,
yeah.
But what we know from our own childhoods or from our children or from watching young people is that there's always a sense of showing off in that period of life among arty types. So there's also, you don't want to go overboard, but you want to
right.
Demonstrate that. You really did something very special. I mean, you've done a number of special things here, but something very special for me, I think, and for many people here, and that was when you did Merry Widow at Lyric. And you really showed us not just talk about Lehar, but you showed us how real this music was and how serious, even in a fun way, operetta could be. And you also showed us, of course, the construction of that music. And I imagine a part two of what you're saying about Puccini is not just that he could sketch out these ideas, but that he could develop them, and that what he did with the complexity of the orchestra is a big part of that.
The craftsmanship is absolutely...
That's the word I was looking for.
is absolutely extraordinary. And the craftsmanship first dramatically, that means before that moment I was talking about, you know, first love or the idea of all of a sudden all the snow melting and the beauty of life being revealed. He has just with the flute, something totally banal, and it's just, oh, I'm a writer, I have no inspiration, and very casual and expressed like this just in passing. But very simply orchestrated, that moment of revelation then happens in a pianissimo of the strings just with the clarinets. It's nothing. And probably another composer would have tried to make something much more complicated. But the way the chord is placed together and the way the clarinet enters in and the theme is developed for the first time is absolutely extraordinary with nothing. So that knowledge of pacing, that knowledge of putting things in layers together, the alchemy, the magic of the combination of the instrument, various instruments of the orchestra, connected to the drama, to the vocal line, is extraordinary. I mean, this is virtuoso like no other composer. Maybe Strauss can do that. Mozart can do that. But very, very few composers can do this.
Thinking, just as you said that, of the way Strauss does this at the ends of some of his operas, sprinkles some notes about.
Right.
It almost looks careless, and it's not at all at the end of Rosenkavalier, at the end of Ariadne, etc. But it's that same idea, ability.
Absolutely. This is an incredible ability to take the medium and with ingredients that are very ordinary and overused, make something totally new and turn it upside down and give new juice to things.
Now, a practical challenge that a conductor faces is how to translate what you've just said into reality with the orchestra and with the singers. Those of you who don't have the video portion of our program, which doesn't exist, missed the eyebrows going up on Emmanuel. But you have a virtuoso and a highly experienced Puccini orchestra here in Chicago. You have singers who even the youngest of them have probably done this opera many times, maybe even in high school, but certainly from student days on. Do you, and I know that maybe you can't answer this for various reasons, but do you try to just demonstrate by example? Do you have a little pep talk at the beginning of the first rehearsals? Do you try to offer some points to think about, or do you try to just channel this out of yourself?
All of the above. And I think it's very important to have that goal in mind, which is to really present the piece as fresh, as vivid, as intense, energized, without suffocating it as possible. And you have to use the people you have in front of you and use the qualities. Question tradition, for instance, on a very practical point of view. There is always a ritenuto here or fermata on that note. Let's talk about it. Let's just deconstruct it slightly and see why we are doing this all the time and if we want to do it.
Some of these things have accreted by tradition or by carelessness, and just everybody thinks they're there.
Of course.
And is it in the score, you're saying?
What does it mean? Score, you know?
Okay.
I mean, because in Puccini there are some rubati, some phrasing, you know, things, stylized phrasing that you cannot write. So what's true and what's not true, there is no literality in music. Or literary music is the absence of music. It's something which is hard to explain, but it's a reality to which we are confronted every day. So some traditions have very bad reasons. For instance, a turn page in the cello. You have a beautiful phrase, then it stops, and it starts again, and you find out that the only reason is because the cello had to turn the page, and everybody is trying to the good conductors, let's say, have tried to make sense out of it, and it does make sense, and the other ones they just pause because Mr. Kleiber has posed there, so I'm going to pose there, you know. So that you have right. to look for. Yeah. Or another reason may be that vocally that passage is very difficult for all the people who have done this, but you might be in front of a tenor that doesn't have that kind of difficulty. So why would we stop here? Why would we stretch that part of the phrase? So that's the kind of question you have to ask yourself and you have to share with your colleagues. And that's fascinating. That's very interesting. When you have an orchestra like the Lyric Orchestra, they are really team players and they like a challenge. So I think what we do, we talk about one or two very specific technical places, and we try to establish principles in phrasing, going over the bars, finishings, the way we stylize the distortion of things, or on the contrary, we want them to be very, very clear and objective. This is all discussions that you have. But the most important thing is, once more, once you have done all of this, is going to go in the pit with your colleagues and try to discover the piece as we do it. Mm-hmm. Having done all that work, needs to be absolutely new. It needs to be a discovery. And there was a very touching moment in rehearsal the other day where we have all seen Mimi die again and again.
Are you giving away the ending?
Yes. Oh, I'm sorry. In this production, maybe she's not dying. I don't know. But we rehearsed a version where she was dying the other day. And we were just rehearsing. And then all of a sudden, I could see we all had tears in our eyes without even having... And that's the kind of things I would like to have. Of course, it's not about us having tears. It's about the audience having tears. So you need to calculate that. But
if you have tears, that's a pretty good sign
yes.
that the audience may have a lot of tears.
Right. And so working that kind of discovering the piece as you go is a big challenge. And it's the challenge we face with every kind of repertoire we do, but especially with Bohème, because it has been done and redone and redone. So you don't want to put this wonderful sauce in the microwave and it doesn't smell and taste the same.
Right. We're speaking with Emmanuel Vihomme. Emmanuel with two M's, and Vihomme is Villaume. He is in Chicago for much of 2013 to conduct two runs of La Bohème at the Lyric Opera of Chicago. We're also going to be talking to him in another program about the many things that he does aside from conduct with Lyric and conduct at Bohème, the Slovak Philharmonic, the Slovenian Philharmonic, Santa Fe Opera. We are going to talk a little bit about in a moment. But because, as you've just heard, Emmanuel has so much to say about things that we think we already know everything about, I want to keep digging around with Puccini and La Bohème for a bit. I'm Andrew Patner. You're listening to Critical Thinking, 98.7 WFMT and WFMT.com. Emmanuel, you're from Strasbourg.
Strasbourg.
But you live in Paris when you are in France. And in fact, you live in Montmartre. So
yes. You
are living La Vie Bohème, or at least of a century ago. Paris today, is there any other than touristic and sense memory connection to the world of these tales or of Puccini's Italianizing of them?
I live in a neighborhood that is called a Bobo neighborhood, and Bobo is referring to bourgeois Bohème. So it's for the people who know Paris, it's on the right bank, just at the feet of Montmartre.
At the feet of Montmartre.
So we have an apartment with a view on Montmartre and the Sacré-Cœur, which was not built in the time of La Bohème.
Never should have been built, as far as I'm concerned.
I I tend to disagree with you, but you know the definition of kitsch by Oscar Wilde. Kitsch yes. is what we like, you know. So.
Well, my problem was as a kid. I guess all the books I'd grown up with of Paris were before that building was built. So when I'm taken there by my parents and I look up and I just said, "What is the Taj Mahal doing on top of Montmartre?"
Taj Mahal is not bad either. No, come on, Andrew, you're digging your hole.
This sounds like Epcot to me.
The sister of my grandmother, who I love dearly, was happy the day an apartment was built in front of her window because she wouldn't have to see the Eiffel Tower anymore.
Yes, there were
she
such
people.
She
hated the Eiffel
right.
Tower. Yeah, well, there are such people who don't like the Sacré-Cœur.
Right.
And you know, in a few years, someone is going to say, I know Andrew Patner, he didn't like
the
Sacré-Cœur.
I just have to add for your great aunt, whom I bet I would love as well, when I had my own little apartment on the very top of a building on the left bank, I was 20 years old, 7 flights without elevator, and this tiny, tiny little room. It looked like Van Gogh's room in his paintings. If you stuck your head into the courtyard, i.e. the garbage chute, and you looked to the left between the building and the drainage pipe, there was La Tour Eiffel. There was the Eiffel Tower. So I had a view, you see,
great.
And that made the apartment that I spent what little money I had to occupy for a
right.
few months. So,
right.
yes, I see your point. So there you are in Boboland.
Boboland. So bourgeois bohème, which is, it's like the Upper West Side, you know. It used to be this dirty West Side Story, a place which is now, you know, you can't buy a closet unless you are a multimillionaire. And so the neighborhood has that kind of cachet. But no, the Paris of today has nothing to do with the Paris of these young people who pretend to take life in an easy way. And I think Paris in many ways has lost a little of its intensity. It's become a very touristy city, which is great. But it's not the center where ideas are produced and exchanged in the way it was in that time, unfortunately. And there are other cities that have that Paris has lost a little.
Tell us about working with the singers and tell us about your two casts.
So we have the cast that's doing the January-February run with Ana Maria Martinez, with an incredible Mimi, very touching, very generous, very human in the way she is portraying that character. And it's a real joy. It's a beautiful voice.
And a lovely person as
and
well.
And she's a very, very real, nice person. Dimitri Pitas is going to be the tenor. And a beautiful voice too, great qualities on stage. A very smart singer. Very, very elaborate singer, sophisticated singer. Second cast in March, we have Joseph Calleja, who is considered one of the best tenor for that part too.
So certainly the Dimitri. Greatest Maltese singer today.
Absolutely.
And much more than that.
Absolutely, and much more than that. And it's the first time we're working together, so I'm really looking forward to it. And Anani Trepko, who is arguably one of the best soprano in the world today, and an extraordinary performer. I mean, this is a voice, for instance, it's one of those voices, you hear it, and it has to be in a Trepko. It's mm-hmm. like Callas. It's,
right.
it's so, so specific, so incredibly unique. She's a performer with an outstanding energy. It's one of these people who go on stage, even if she doesn't mean to attract the attention, the eyes are going to go directly to mm-hmm. her. Mm-hmm. I experienced that with Placido Domingo too. I was going to the Met in a performance of Parsifal, and in the third act, you know, Gournemanz is telling all history.
You were there as an audience member.
As an audience
member. You
have member.
Conducted at the Met, but you were there
as
an audience member.
I was just as an audience
okay.
member. I just went actually just for the third act.
Yeah, why not?
So you have Gournemanz telling all this story and blah, 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 blah for half an hour. And the poor guy who was great, you know, with his lungs on stage and in the back, you see just a guy in an armor coming in. You don't really know who this is. There is nothing. It's just plastic pretending to be iron in the back of the stage. And I bet you, during this half hour, the guy was staying in the back. Everybody was looking at him. And it was Placido Domingo hidden in an armor, in a costume. Mm-hmm. But there was something about this magnetism of the Domingo that was made it impossible to listen or look at anything else. And Anani Trepko is like this.
Now, you can say this from really long experience and heavy experience, because you have worked with Netrebko more than many, many people have, because you have worked with her on recordings, you've worked with her on tours, she sings mm-hmm. with your orchestra. How did this connection begin with you and Anna Netrebko?
We did a concert a little by chance together, and with Rolando Villazon in the Barbican and in Vienna.
So in London and Vienna.
Yeah. London and mm-hmm. Vienna, yes.
And when? How many years ago? You and I are not big on dates.
No, I'm horrible on dates. It's probably more than 10 years ago.
Okay. Yeah, okay.
Between 10 and 15 years ago. And we clicked immediately.
So you were a baby conductor.
I was even more of a baby than today.
Right, right.
Yes.
You are a young conductor today.
and we clicked right away. And then we did other concerts like this. Anna doesn't want to do any more those big gala concerts mm-hmm. where you have to put all the arias of the repertoire on
right,
stage
right.
and all the critics are just waiting for you to not do right on La Vallée and on Butterfly. So I did record for Deutsche Grammophon with her an album where she's doing a lot of these various things, which I think is a success.
Thank you.
we decided to do a project together, which was to play in concert an opera. And this is Yolanta of Tchaikovsky that we just did together in a tour all over Europe. We played at Berlin Philharmonie. We played at Salle Pleyel. We played in Vienna at the Concertgebouw in Amsterdam. And that was really a wonderful experience because there she was on stage, but in concert with a part that is probably the best part for her today, with Bohème. It was a wonderful experience because she didn't feel like that pressure you have to do so many arias one after the other.
Well, and also the audience knows Tchaikovsky, but they don't know Yolanta.
Yolanta, yes.
And it's not like those who are sitting there with baseball or football scorecards looking for, quote, mistakes.
Yes.
They don't even know the score. So
right.
you're liberated from that.
Yes.
And it's what, about an hour long?
It's an hour and a half.
But it's 1 hour
and a half.
It's not with an, or did you do it with an interval?
It's less than even 1 hour and a half. It's 1 hour 15 or 10,
right,
something like that.
Right.
We did it without interval.
Right.
We wanted to do it without interval.
I think the last time it was done here was in a very wonderful, actually, production by high school singers as a part of Chicago Opera Theater, the other company here. So part of their educational program. Alexander Platt made a smaller orchestration, and another colleague made an English version. And, of course, everybody came out of this in a school auditorium saying, why aren't opera companies presenting this? And there used to be a period where there would be these double bills.
Right.
That's
the problem. It can be done only nowadays in a double bill. It was done at the premiere in a double bill with Nutcracker.
Right. Can you imagine?
Yeah. What an evening. Yeah.
And whatever happened to Nutcracker?
Yeah, I know. But that's one of the reasons a piece is not performed often. It's just technicalities. Like, it's too short to work. And then as a double bill, what do you do? And usually people try to do a double bill with the same cast. So the piece didn't get a chance. It's a perfect piece for a concert also because, in a way, she's blind in the piece. It's a blind girl and so on. And finally, through love, she recovers sight. And so a lot of it is left to the imagination. You don't need to have a lot, because a lot is just a description of what is in the heart, in the soul, and the mind.
And if you have Yatremko on the bill, then you are able to put on something like this without having to pad it with another two operas or 2 hours of music.
If you do it in concert,
right,
anyway,
that's what I mean.
A concert is, the concert format is rarely more than 1 hour 90 of music. An opera can be 6 hours.
Now, my guess is, given that relationship and given her abilities and given that she's coming from the former Soviet Union, that there are things that you learn from her as well as she gets from you when you're working together on a project like Yolanta.
Absolutely. When you work on a project like Yolanta, I mean, you are very humble and you try to understand, which doesn't mean you don't point out to all of a sudden, well, listen here, this is a quarter note. I mean, let's at least talk about it. Anna is not... she's not someone who is going to abstractly discuss with you a score. It's the process is going to be more in the moment. You rehearse, and she's all of a sudden having, no, this should be a little more lively, or let's take our time here. And so she's not going to have a big intellectual discussion about things like, you know, I worked with Domingo and we would just all of a sudden stop and talk about it and what it means. But there is a lot to learn. And we then recorded the piece for Deutsche Grammophon, and we had one of the coaches I wanted to have, because my Russian is unfortunately quite limited, I wanted to have for the recording one of the top coaches of the Mravinsky, who went and worked with us, and that was also a very interesting discussion on the piece and the traditions of the piece. I personally listened to a lot of the recordings, the whole recordings, to see where things were. But Anna's approach was very practical and in some way, in the best way, instinctual. But her instinct with this language are amazing. Mm-hmm. I mean, and when you do with her Rachmaninoff, songs. I mean, it's the color, the connection between the meaning and the sound is extraordinary. I mean, absolutely unique, because it's our natural language.
And so have you now stored up enough points with each other and with that experience that if when she's singing Bohème and singing in French, she might listen to someone from Strasbourg about a phrase or pronunciation?
Yeah, it's a very, you know, you will realize that working with megastar like her is in many ways easier than to work with other people. They are very open to critique.
If they trust you.
If they trust you, yes. But usually if you're in front of them, that means they trust you because they have to approve of you.
That's right.
You know?
That's right.
So there are a lot of things you don't need to discuss. You just look at each other or even, you know, in a rehearsal. Okay, yes, okay, I understand what you mean. You want more time here. You need to breathe there. But she would absolutely listen to what I had to say, which is normal. I mean, although she is Anna Netrebko, I'm still a conductor, so I have to tell her when she's wrong.
Right.
And she tells me when she thinks, you know, you're just missing the point here, or I'm trying to do this. Please don't be in the way.
You mentioned the beginning of Bohème. Could you mention maybe one or two other moments or parts of the opera that the audience might not normally have its antennae up for, that it ought to be listening for, whether they're vocal or instrumental or even stage dramatic? Are there some points that people tend to think they should start reading their program, then instead they should be listening hard?
I think there is not one single moment in Bohème that is not extraordinary, riveting, that captivates you. So even the moment where the intensity goes down a little and then it goes back up are done with such craftsmanship, such intelligence that there is nothing. I mean, the librettist, had written an extra act, and he dropped it. So that music, you can just maybe, you know, shimed out and take another book. It's already cut. So don't just stay there. I mean, I'm trying.
You used the example earlier of the marble, and in a way,
right.
This is, you know, the famous stories of Michelangelo and other sculptors that their job was to remove what shouldn't be there, and then you were left with the masterwork.
And reveal the
form. And you're saying everything's already been removed.
It's already totally removed, yes. I really think so. And there are passages where for myself, I discover maybe other ways to do it, you know. Mm-hmm. But I really don't see what it is that you would say, okay, well, this part it didn't work, you know, or he's milking it too much with no purpose. I mean, in a way, that is a perfect work.
Do you? It's a dangerous question, or it used to be a dangerous question. I think with people of younger generations, it's less of one because people maybe have grown up with recordings, and also perhaps they're more willing to answer, be more honest about it. But do you have any favorite recording or recordings of this opera?
And if
you want to stick to people who are no longer
stage,
I can. That's fine. But
there is a. Actually, people like to trash the Karajan version. Mm-hmm. I think it's so rich orchestrally that it does reveal a lot. Of course, if you try to do this, it just doesn't work because you don't have maybe the velvet and the muscles of the Berlin Philharmonie or the Vienna. I don't know if that recording, if it's one or the other, to do it. It's pretty remarkable. There is the Björling version with Bitschem, which is a reference for everybody, and it's still a reference to me. There is actually Scholti has a good version too. There is something that is a real, real treat that I discovered lately and that you can see on YouTube, which is Kleiber's version with La Scala. And Pavarotti, and I think it's I don't remember who the Mimi is, but that is an extraordinary version. That is a wonderful version, and it was interesting to me because I didn't know of it. So.
Right. Well, Emmanuel Villaume, thank you so much for sharing with us A Thinking Person's Guide to La Boheme. And I think it's a reminder to us keep our noses out of the air and focus our eyes and our ears on the stage and on the score when we are thinking about a piece of music or attending a concert. You know that Lyric Opera is going to present Puccini in the way Puccini should be presented, not overdoing it, but certainly recognizing that this is a theatrical work, dramatically as well as musically. And Emmanuel Villaume will be leading two runs of La Boheme, the first with Anna Maria Martinez and Dimitri Pitas in January and February at the Civic Opera House, and then in March and April with Anna Netrebko and Joseph Kalea.
I would say
until we get him in here to give us the authentic Maltese production pronunciation, we're going to say Joseph Kalea, the rest of the cast, and the Lyric Opera of Chicago
Great
Orchestra.
Cast. The rest of the cast is fantastic. We have Lucas Mitchum singing Marcello. It's a wonderful voice, great character on stage, and Elisabeth Futral was a Chicago singer, as you know, doing Musetta in a very wonderfully charming way.
Yeah, these will both of the individuals you mentioned will be great physical assets to the production as well as vocal and musical assets. In a few weeks, when Matt DeStefano and I get back from the Far East with the Chicago Symphony Orchestra and Riccardo Muti, you will be hearing our conversation with Emmanuel Villaume about the things that he does when he's not conducting La Boheme, and those are many and also very interesting. We want to thank Emmanuel Villaume for coming in to talk about Boheme with us. We want to thank Jack Zimmerman from Lyric Opera of Chicago for helping to make this interview possible. We thank, as ever, Matt DeStefano for making the program sound great as our producing engineer. We'd like to thank our funders, Alpha Wood Foundation, Richard and Susan Kiphart, and other friends of this program. Drop us a line. Let us know what you thought of this or any of our other programs. Rentap, that's Patner spelled backwards, R-E-N-T-A-P at AOL.com. Or click on the Chime In feature when you are at WFMT.com. And while you are at WFMT.com, add /critical thinking. Where you can experience the always free Critical Thinking podcast. Music that we heard tonight, we opened with Emmanuel Viaume conducting the Prague Philharmonia with Anna Netrebko, joined in the opening by Elena Garancha, mezzo, in the barcarolle from The Tales of Hoffmann. Midway, we heard from Emmerich Kallmann's The Czardash Princess, Haya in den Bergen, home, home in the mountains, with Netrebko, the recording made March 2008 in the Dvorak Hall of the Rudolfinum in Prague and released in 2008 on the Deutsche Grammophon label. And then we closed with the final section of Act Two of La Boheme in this legendary recording, now available on YouTube. Carlos Kleiber, La Scala, March 30th, 1979. No attempts, no money was ever able to work out getting a commercial recording of Boheme by Kleiber, infamously independent. Iliana Kotrabas, Luciano Pavarotti, Lorenzo Saccomanni, and the late Lucia Popp. A Boheme that has to be seen and heard, and fortunately now can be done on YouTube. Even if Mimi dies in the end, what did I want to say? I'm Andrew Patner. See you next week.